You know, for a long time, I meant to try Pete's Coffee, but just never gave it a chance. But ever since I did, I have a hard time settling on anything less.
And there's something to say about a coffee company with such rich history and devotion to bring you that perfect brew.
Since Alfred Pete opened his first coffee bar in 1966, Pete's has selectively sourced the finest beans in the world, carefully calibrating each roast by hand and crafting each beverage with the utmost care.
Pete's aims to produce fresh from the roaster's coffee delivered directly to your door, sourcing the top 1% of coffee beans, roasted by hand to unlock each bean's potential, and delivering it to you fresh to bring you the perfect cup.
With over 30 flavor varieties in both gourmet coffees and teas, like Vietnam Lotus Bold, Major Dickinson's Blend, and Arabian Mocha Java, you are sure to find the right flavor to start your day. And they even come in K-Cups for those of you who live life on the go.
Check out all the varieties of Pete's has to offer by following the link in the show notes below.
And starting August 30th, you can take advantage of their Labor Day sale and get yourself 20% off anything on their site by using promo code LABORDAY20 at checkout. This offer is valid through September 5th. That's promo code LABORDAY20 at checkout for 20% off your purchase this Labor Day.
But why not do one better? Use promo code NEWSUB30 at checkout and you get yourself 30% off of a new subscription to Pete's Coffee. That's right. All the delicious coffee you could want delivered right to your door each and every month without you ever having to worry about running low. What more could you ever need? That's promo code NEWSUB30 for 30% off your subscription.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Spread the word, you dirty cocksuckers. Tell all your grave robbing friends on what the matter of the city now!
The nightmare of insane murder.
From the depths of hell.
The angel of death.
Only at the Grindhouse.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to Grindhouse, where we drink coffee and talk about movies. My name is Sean Tatro, and today with my girlfriend and co-host, Dalia Diana, we will be winding back the reel to 1979. A psychopathic killer terrorizes a babysitter, then returns 7 years later to menace her again in When a Stranger Calls. Let's get into it.
Warm September evening.
Dr. Malakis?
Jill Johnson was babysitting for the two young children of a wealthy doctor.
Okay. Bye.
They told her where they would be and when they would be home. They told her everything she had to know, except what to do when a stranger calls.
Hello?
Have you checked the children?
What? Hello, could you get me the police?
Well, there's really nothing you can do about it down here.
Have you checked the children?
He's watching me through the windows.
Well, if he calls again, we can try to trace it.
Why haven't you checked the children?
Please, can't you help me? I'm all alone here. What do you want?
Your blood.
Leave me alone!
Jill, this is Sergeant Sacker. We've traced the call. It's coming from inside the house. Jill, just get out of that house.
And the terror just begins when a stranger calls.
To menace her again?
To menace her again. That is the official synopsis according to IMDb.
Would you say that IMDb is sometimes not a great source of information, or even, you know, for experts on grammatical.
It can be run by clowns. Well, it doesn't help that they allow for user submission.
Yeah, it's sort of like Wikipedia.
Yeah, yeah. So it doesn't always have the greatest information.
No, no, it does not.
So this was your first viewing of When a Stranger Calls.
It is, because I have never seen this movie or the remake. I have only heard about them.
Well, this is probably most notoriously one of the big movies that was an inspiration for Scream.
Yeah, I can definitely see that now.
Most specifically, the opening, what was it?
23 minutes. That's what it says.
23 minutes of this, but I think it might be the opening 15 minutes of Scream. I don't know the exact runtime. But
what I think is funny is this is called the best 23 minutes of horror film history.
Can you see why?
Yeah, I can actually see why. Because once that whole scene is over, the movie gets really boring and reminds me of Death Wish.
It's kind of funny you say that.
Why?
Well, it didn't remind me of Death Wish so much. I get where you're coming from with that. Because it essentially turns into like a...
It's like a revenge film.
Well, sort of. But it turns into like a procedural, like, cop hunting a killer kind of thing. But it started to remind me more of Maniac, which is another movie you haven't seen.
I have seen the remake with Elijah Wood. I have not seen the original Maniac.
But do you get where I'm coming from with that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, I do get where you're coming from with it.
I think this is a very interesting movie, and I think there's going to be some fun stuff to talk about with this one.
Okay. Spoof it, so I stopped it. You make fun of me, motherfucker?
No, I just didn't know you were doing. So today, as we said, we watched When a Stranger Calls, which is a 1979 American psychological thriller written and directed by Fred Walton. The film famously stars Charles Durning, Carol Kane, Colleen Dewhurst, and Tony Beckley. This movie was originally released September 28th, 1979. It was made on a budget of $1.5 million. And ended up bringing in a box office of somewhere between 21.4 and 25 million.
Damn.
So this was quite the little success. Something I found interesting was that Tony Beckley, who played our killer of the movie,
our bad guy,
he was terminally ill throughout this entire production.
With what?
I do not know what he was diagnosed with, but apparently his illness caused him to lose a significant amount of weight. So he was extremely frail, which made him not really fit the physical description of the killer in the script. But he was a close friend of the director. So the director absolutely refused to recast him. Unfortunately, Tony Beckley later passed away just after principal photography finished. And they actually ended up dedicating the sequel, When a Stranger Calls Back, to his memory.
Oh. So this says here that the cause of the death was given as cancer or a brain tumor, but it appeared mysteriously. According to his friend Sheila Hancock, it could have been AIDS because the disease was almost unknown back then.
That's very
because
true.
The way he was appearing follows the trend of what AIDS would have been back in the 80s or the 70s and 80s. So,
thank you.
Okay.
I personally have to say that, like, his performance throughout this movie is great.
It's disturbingly terrifying.
His voice alone is probably has become one of the most chilling voice.
Just hearing voices in how film. He says, "Have you checked the children yet?"
Oh
that fucking
God.
Line. Just, especially the first time you hear it.
Yeah, you're like, oh, you're uncomfortable the first time you hear it.
"Have you checked the children?" Oh,
but
God.
Then he says it a second time, and it goes from, oh, to, And then by the time he says it's the third time, you're sitting there going, don't fucking check those kids. Don't check those kids. Don't do it. They're already dead. Just fucking go. Run. No.
Well, it's kind of interesting because when you think about that scene as it plays out. So at first it just seems like a menacing phone call. Mm. But like the more with how frequent the calls come in and like the more you hear him saying that, it, especially on a rewatch, like once you know what's going to happen, watching it again, you then realize like he's begging you to go up there so he can kill you too.
Yep. And you just keep
it's so fucking eerie.
Terrifying.
Now, the thing about this movie, like you said, it's notorious for these first 23 minutes, these opening 23 minutes of the film. So it's essentially the first act. If you were to break this into three acts, you have the opening, this notorious opening, followed by the second act, which is basically a cat and mouse between the detective and the killer. Mm-hmm. And then, sort of cat and mouse. I use that term loosely. And then the third act is the big finale. So this movie is famous for the opening. After that, most people don't really like the way the movie goes. Mm. And I can understand why. So much so that when they remade this movie in 2006, the entire movie is the opening scene of this version.
And the opening scene of this has been featured on so many shows.
Yeah.
Just the countdown for Shudder, and I believe it's in Search of Darkness.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
I don't know which number it is. We've only seen number one.
I think it was in the first one.
It had to have been, because we have two and three, and we haven't committed to it, because each one is like 4.5 to 5 hours long.
Yeah.
The first one took 2 days for us to watch, because we're like, oh, we'll start it at night, and then we're like, we gotta go to bed. We still have like 2 hours left to this. Yeah. Like, shit! Yeah.
No, so like when they remade the movie, essentially they took that opening 23 minutes and they fleshed it out into a full hour and a half.
I will be honest, having watched this, having known what those first like 20 minutes are, and now having watched this, I think the idea of the remake is much better than this movie. I like it because it is a movie that is a just fucking slow ass burn. That's all the movie is. It's a slow burn. It's an adrenaline, edge of your seat movie.
But you haven't seen the remake.
I have not seen the remake, no.
In concept, you're correct. It's a much better idea. In execution, not so much.
Look.
It hurts.
Look.
It's hindered a little bit. There are things about the remake I like. The guy that they got to play the killer in the remake is a bit of an unexpected casting choice, and like he's somebody that I had seen in other things.
And you were like, oh.
And I was like, oh, that's a cool choice of casting. Mm. But it's not as slow burn as you would like it to be. And it feels like a very early 2000s movie.
Okay.
I think we're going to talk a lot about this opening 23 minutes.
Yeah.
Before we get into like the rest of the movie. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of our focus is going to stay here because it's the most prominent part of the film.
There's a reason why this first 20 minutes is called one of the best horror film like
moments.
It's one of the best horror film moments in all of horror film history. It is terrifying. Now, it's dated because it's the 70s, and there's so many things that you can go, like the way the cop talks to her, the way the people kind of like make, like the way he makes her feel like, oh, you're being ridiculous. I hate that, but that's part of the charm of it.
That's actually a good thing, good point that you bring up there. This movie very obviously takes place in a vastly different time.
Oh, God, yeah.
So, like you said, the people talk to each other differently. Women are kind of looked down upon. The thing that grabbed me immediately and set me back into late 70s with this was the protagonist is meeting this family that she's babysitting for the first time.
Yep.
On the night that she's babysitting for them.
Yes.
That would never happen now.
You have to go to a website. You have to get you as the babysitter has to get vetted, background checks. Honestly, all of this shit. Back then, you just call Susie across the street, come watch your kids, you're going out.
Babysitters in general aren't really used now. Most people just use family members or people they already know. Most people aren't going to hire some rando off the streets.
And usually when you're looking for a babysitter, you are looking for a teenage, either like late teens, early 20s girl. You're looking for somebody who this is just a pickup job to help out. You're not looking for a nanny. You're not looking for somebody to watch your kids full time. You're looking for somebody, basically this back then was, oh, I just need you to watch the kids for a couple hours. That's it. Yeah. And you would professionally call around. Oh, hey, does Susie need like a couple extra bucks for like prom season? Oh, we're going to go out. Parents didn't go out like this all the time.
No.
And usually, like growing up in the 70s, my mom is one of four. So her parents would have the older kids watch the younger kids. Like, because my mom's age gap between her and her younger sister and brother are a little bit bigger. She's closer in age to her older brother. Like, it's weird. I mean, the same thing with me. Like, I'm a decade older than my siblings. So growing up in the 90s, I would be the babysitter. I didn't get paid. I'd watch my brother and sister all the time. So it's not something like you can see the difference between back in the 70s, you just babysat kids. And then now it's like, well, I don't want a stranger here. I'll have my kid. I'll have somebody I know.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's just a sign of the times.
Yeah. Nowadays it's like, oh, I'm going to call my aunt to watch the kid or
if you were really poor. Back in the late, early 90s, you left your kid home alone and nobody cared.
They were latchkey kids.
Yep, I was a latchkey kid. I literally would walk home from kindergarten. Now, kindergarten was right behind my house. I went to school at a Catholic school for kindergarten.
Yeah.
Oh, no, kindergarten was, I went to a Catholic school, but it wasn't right behind my house. This bus would drop me off at home. I would go in the house. I knew how to peel the potatoes, put them on the stove, start them up at a certain time. I knew that you had to take the food out of the thing to put it on the counter so it would defrost a little more. So when mom was ready to come home, you'd make it. I knew when my brother and sister weren't around way back when. I knew I had to clean up. I knew I had to start the laundry. Like, I had chores at 5 and 6 that my nephew would never even bat it. Would think you're being retarded. Back that up. My nephew would think you're being stupid for giving me these chores. I had to do these chores every single day.
Well, to be fair, your nephew's a spoiled kid.
Sorry, Paige. He's a little...
She knows he's spoiled.
She knows he's spoiled. But, like, I was one of those latchkey kids. We never locked the door. We always answered the phone when people called.
It was a different era.
It was a different era. I mean, I was born in 85, so it's only 6 years away from this film.
Nowadays.
Oh, I don't answer my phone. Door stays locked. Somebody comes around. The whole house goes dark. You pretend like you're dead.
Yeah.
I don't want people. Well, I don't care.
We live in an era now where everything is terrifying. Like, we shine so much light on the dark corners of the world now. Like, we're constantly on the lookout for those who are trying to hurt us.
Right?
Like, that's literally day-to-day life now. Like, and it's awful.
We live in an okay area. It's not the best, but it's not the worst. And we still have to worry about some strung-out druggie going through our cars if they're hidden from sight. Right before our neighbor's wedding, the day before, all of our cars got broken into.
Yeah.
And it was a matter of our cars were hidden from the street. That's how they got in them. They were just looking for extra cash. I mean, there was plenty of equipment they could have stolen out of the car to sell. But they didn't touch
anything. Thankfully, they didn't.
Like, I had stuff strewn on the lawn. It was literally just, like, like smelly things from Bed Bath and Beyond for the fucking car, yeah. like car clings or whatever the fuck they're called. Our neighbor, just all of her trash was strewn all over her car. But it's shit like that where the person that did it, they finally caught them. They were just teenagers. They were looking for cash. That was it. They had gotten their a hold of a universal car opener, and that's how they got into everybody's cars. But it was only the cars that were hidden from the street. So if your car was on the street, they didn't hit it. But if it was hidden somewhere else, they got it. But it's stuff like that that back then, you didn't lock your car. You left your keys in the visor.
Right.
Like, up until I was maybe about 6 or 7, my parents had one of the cars that the keys were in the visor. Like, it was no big deal. You didn't lock your doors. You didn't lock your cars. My sister, until she had money stolen out of her car, would leave her purse in her car unlocked because she lived in the really nice area. Well, now the really nice area is getting hit with people getting their cars broken into the same time we did.
Yeah.
And she was like, yeah, they stole all the change out of my car, but that was it.
Well,
and I was like, you leave your purse in there unlocked.
To be fair, if you have any measure of intelligence whatsoever, I'm not saying Paige is stupid, but
what I just tell you 20 minutes ago while we were watching a YouTube video.
Yeah, I know.
She is book smarts. That girl is not street smarts.
If you have any measure of intelligence, you're going to think about, oh, if somebody's, if I'm a criminal, where am I going to go break into people's cars or houses? The poor part of town or the rich part of town?
You're going to want to hit the rich part of town, but you've got the risks where this doesn't happen. Our neighbors just got one too, and they're everywhere. You have Ring cameras, home surveillance, not just like ADT or any of that shit. You've got these handmade kind of Google Ring Nest kind of situations where we have two friends who you walk in the house, you go, Alexa, turn on this light. Alexa, do this. Alexa, lock the front door. Alexa, do this. Like, old technology. She can see, they can see what's going on in their house anywhere they are. Doesn't matter. If they're on a cruise, oh, that was the dog. That's fine.
They're a very tech-savvy couple.
They are, but, like, you would never imagine in this. Like, that guy would have been caught instantly if there was a Ring camera or if there are cameras everywhere, because the people who own the place would have seen some dude broke in.
Right.
Like, I want to know, how the fuck did Duncan get in?
That's a good question.
That is,
and
the
it's one that's never answered.
Like, how? There are a number of ways, because the house had a lattice design to it.
Yeah.
So he could have climbed in. There could have been a window, but any way possible. But it shows the flaws of the thinking of, oh, we're safe. Nothing will happen.
That's another vast difference that I want to
point out between this and the other one.
So in this original movie, there, the house that she's babysitting at the beginning, it's just an average, not, it's a little bit upscale, but it's in a neighborhood surrounded by other houses.
Yeah.
It's your everyday house. Similar to the one we live in.
Do you know what house it reminds me of?
What?
It reminds me of the JonBenet Ramsey house. Because
I don't
it has
even
that,
what that looks
so
like.
So it has like that lattice style of wood and the wood beams, and it has the plants. It's kind of dark. We watched the VHS copy and it was kind of dark, but I think if we watched the Blu-ray, we'd see a little more detail. But to me, there was a clear path of how that person got in there. There was a window up there and there was lattice work. And I'm like, that's how he got in. He literally climbed in the window. He waited for to see the parents downstairs and he climbed in the window. Also, if he quote unquote ripped the children apart, how did you not hear?
Yeah, that's a good question. But in the remake of this, the house is like a very modern design, like architect style house that's like out in the middle of fucking nowhere. So like there's a vast difference in when you set something off the beaten path, isolated, and in a neighborhood, because personally, like, if a story is set out isolated in the middle of nowhere, that's generic horror movie to me.
Yes.
Like, that's like, okay, so obviously no help is coming. That's how that feeling is set. When you set it in an everyday neighborhood, it
in the middle of New York, in a nice area in New York City,
it brings the horror home.
Yeah,
like it brings it much closer to where the viewer has to go back home and be afraid that this could happen to them.
Yeah.
I think that was way smarter in this version. Personally.
It brings it home because we live in a... We live in a suburban neighborhood outside of a major city.
Yeah.
We're not in the major city, but we're pretty...
Pretty close.
Like, it's this, which is the city, and then there's another city, and then Providence is right there.
We're about 10 minutes.
10 minutes from the heart of Providence. 10 minutes. Other places that you think about, if you're 10 minutes from the heart of Houston or Dallas or Boston, you're still in Boston.
Yeah.
You're still in New York City. Like, 10 minutes away from Providence. Now, if you go 20 minutes away from Providence, you're in fucking Western Coventry. You are in the boonies. Rhode Island is such a weird place to live because you go from these big cities like Warwick, Coventry. No, not Coventry. So Warwick, Cranston, Pawtucket, Woonsocket. That's a huge city. Central Falls. And then 20 minutes away, you've got, you know, South County, you've got Western Coventry, you got East Greenwich, you got West Greenwich. Like, it's the only state in the world where Rhode Island is a weird state because a horror movie in this state, like The Purge, one of The Purges was filmed in like Woonsocket, Cumberland. It was the...
I haven't seen all of them, so I don't know.
It was the really political driven one. Oh, I forget which one. I think it's like number 3. Or 4, but that was filmed here. Rhode Island is a very terrifying place because you go 10 minutes away from the city and you're in the middle of nowhere. And then you got like Connecticut on one side of us, which that is where the remake would have taken place, is in the middle of nowhere, the woods, no one can hear you scream. You know, this movie could be set in this fucking house. That's how terrifying it is.
Yeah.
I don't know, I just went on a tangent. Stupid.
So before we get too much further, I think we should shift over to the back of the box.
Back of the box. The great big back of the box.
Now, the version that we watched today, we have it on VHS.
And we watched from one of our premium tapes.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
And this is the Columbia Pictures home video. Well, Columbia TriStar home video release. It's that nice red border box.
Oh, yeah.
I got so lucky finding this one out thrifting.
Oh, yeah.
Man, I love that I own this. So with these releases, it's pretty pretty universal that the back of the box is very simple. It's basically just stills from the movie and a description. We get no quotes attributed to anybody, none of that extra bullshit.
We don't need that bullshit.
We don't need it. The art sells itself. A terrified young babysitter and an increasingly ringing phone and whispered threats set the stage for one of the most suspenseful chillers ever filmed. Carol Kane stars as the babysitter who is tormented by a series of ominous phone calls until a compulsive cop, Charles Durning, is brought onto the scene to apprehend the psychotic killer. Several years later, however, the nightmare begins again when the madman returns to mercilessly haunt Kane, now a wife and mother. No longer a naive girl, though still terrified, but prepared. She moves boldly to thwart the maniac's attack in scenes that culminate in a nerve-shattering conclusion. 97 minutes, color. I take a few issues with that.
Yeah, the description's kind of a lie. It's telling you who she is. She is a babysitter for 20 minutes. This movie's over an hour and a half long. So 20 minutes of this are like the central part, and then she's not back until the last half of the movie. There's a whole big chunk where it's not about her at all.
She's not in the second act at all. So, all right, our protagonist for this movie, she's your standard meek, like, simple, quiet girl. She's very reminiscent of, like, Laurie Strode in Halloween, which this came out 1 year after that.
One year.
So I actually ended up, by the time we see her again towards the end of the film, I actually had a lot of problems with her character. So like at the beginning, completely understood, like this is our character, this is our protagonist, one of them, at least. But by the end, I had a really hard fucking time believing that she would even entertain the idea in the first place of going out and having a babysitter watch her kids after what she lived through.
Yeah, that was one of the big ones. I was like, wait a minute, hang on.
Like, I understand it's been 7 years. So, like, yeah, maybe she loosened up a little, but no. There's no fucking way. Especially if you live in the same place. She lives in the same state.
Yeah.
If she had moved halfway across the country, sure.
Yeah.
All right. I would have believed it more. But no. Like, what the fuck?
I don't believe for 1 second. Because it says that, oh, she uses her wits and she's strong. Do you see how she broke down?
The description of this feels a little more like... So they're describing the opening of this movie, touching upon the second act, and then they're talking more about the second movie.
Yeah.
Because I know she's more of like a prepared badass in the second one.
I saw no bad... I mean, she was pretty together as the babysitter, but as the mother, no.
She fucking fell apart.
And she did.
You know what? Rightfully so.
I mean, yeah, that's a lot of trauma right there. Like, oh, hey, the dude that, you know, tortured me when I was a child or a teenager, you know, he's back again. That is terrifying to think about.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, you're sitting there going, no fucking way in hell is she leaving those kids.
I really loved the sound design in this movie.
When the suspense picked up, I can actually describe what that noise was. Does everybody listening know the THX noise that would happen at the beginning of Star Wars films? The... That's the noise, almost like it, that plays when it gets suspenseful or something's picking up. But then it continues with like this orchestra in the background, and it is actually pretty fucking terrifying.
Yeah, the sound design and the score both kind of work together really well, especially during that opening 23 minutes.
Yes.
They, like, the very first couple of scenes are actually very mundane. Babysitter comes in, parents leave, she's hanging out alone, she talks to, I think, a friend on the phone for a little while.
Trying to get a boy to call her, which I was like, yeah, sounds like babysitter shit.
And then there's that initial... phone call. First time we hear him say, have you checked the children?
Have you checked the children? No. Why am I supposed to?
So, the way they do the sound in this movie, they utilize the silence really well. And I think that's the aim with that is to like heighten that isolation that she is feeling. So she's alone in this house, kids are asleep upstairs. This is a new place. She's never been here before. They allow certain sounds to kind of grab your attention and consume you. Most notably, the phone. And it's interesting because Fred Walton, the director, actually made it a point to gradually increase the feeling of suspense by making each subsequent phone call ring a touch louder than the previous one.
I was wondering if I was fucking crazy if I sat on the remote at one point. Because I get the remote because I'm fucking deaf, okay? And at one point, I was like, oh, okay, this is a good volume. And the phone just kept getting louder, and I just kept going, the fuck is happening?
Well, his idea was that first time, it's eerie. And then it becomes jarring. And then it's infuriating because he keeps calling. And it almost, like, it brings you to this, like, point of, like, madness because he's persistently calling again and again, scolding her. Why haven't you checked the children? Why haven't you checked the children? And like we said, it's because he wants her to come up there.
Yeah.
He's trying to lure her from the safety of downstairs. It's a
game to him.
It's so, like, and then, like, afterwards when you are getting, because you never see anything in this movie. So when you're getting the description of what he did to the kids.
Oh my God.
You're just like, oh, like, that's what he was gonna do to you.
Yep.
It is so fucked up. I love it.
I could just... at that point, if I was her, and this dude was like... I wouldn't have had children. I would have been like, nope, too afraid to have children. Because this man's gonna try and find me and kill my children. Nope.
Yeah, it's really weird. Like, that, the decision that they made with her character.
Jill, right?
Yeah. With Jill's character is very strange. Like, it doesn't add up. It almost feels like two separate people.
So I can answer that. Mental health back then was not, nobody looked at. It was not a thing you looked at. Look at this dude. He's obviously... was a lot of mental issues. They threw him in a psychiatric place where, describing what he was going through, they did shock therapy, they did electrotherapy, they gave him all these pills, they sedated him constantly. He was just a teddy bear while he was in psychiatric hold because he was drugged up as fuck. That was their idea to deal with mental health back then. So you're thinking, this girl went through all this trauma. There was nothing, nobody to counsel her, none of that stuff that they do now. Sure, they had, like, psychologists and all that stuff, but it's not what it is today. So in my mind, to her, okay, I've had trauma, I just need to put it past me and get going and just continue life because this is what society told me I have to do. I have to get married, I have to have children, I have to have a good job, I have to be successful and pass everything to them. If this happened to me as a teenager, you bet your ass, I am childless and I am living somewhere where no one can find me.
So you actually touch on something that I want to talk a little bit about.
Okay.
Because I found this extremely interesting. Now, this isn't the first time I've seen this movie, but this is the first time I've seen this movie with an analytical brain.
Okay.
So, like, I saw this when I was younger. Like,
why am I not fucking surprised?
Not a little kid, but, like,
what were you, younger. Like, 7, 8?
No, probably, like, double digits somewhere.
So, like, 10.
I don't know, but I'd seen it in passing. Like, it was never a favorite movie. Mm. And since most of the movie after the beginning is kind of dull, I can understand why.
Yeah.
But watching it this time, I found something very interesting about the whole second and third acts.
Okay.
So the film is kind of attempting to deliver a unique viewpoint on, like, that slasher format, which was something very new at the time.
Mm.
Halloween's the movie that really started that format.
Yeah.
So this was only a year later. There may have been a couple others around the same time, because once Halloween was a success, everybody tried to cash in on that.
Yeah.
Now, the first act of this movie, basic stalker home invasion style experience, which it's one of the first.
Yeah.
As we move into the second act, it takes things in a new direction. It starts to become more of a procedural thriller, private detective.
Suspense.
Yeah, tracking down a killer. But what's more interesting about this part of the movie is that it also chooses to allow you to become familiar with who our killer is as a character. Rather than keeping him hidden away from us, like, unseen, like, just this threat against our protagonist, we are given him as a man, not just a monster. So we start to see him as he's beginning to slide back into his old habits, but we're learning about him as a person. So it this is why it reminded me of Maniac so much. is because Maniac kind of puts you in the point of view, like the remake literally puts you in the point of view.
Yeah.
But it puts you alongside the villain, the antagonist of the story. So this middle part of the movie does a similar thing, and it humanizes the killer in a way that most other movies don't even try to. So it's, in a small way, it kind of makes the opening and ending sequences more impactful, because then you understand the deranged mind that's at play in these situations.
Now, they said he was a fisherman, right?
I honestly don't even remember.
I think they said he was a fisherman, and one of the things that intrigued me about that was, as a fisherman, he would be trapped or confined for a while.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's see. Yeah, they had mentioned that he was a long haul fisher or some sort of fisherman.
That would make sense.
To where it makes sense for the spiral that he goes down, where he was like, I'm hidden, I'm alone, I was never born. And you start to think, okay, this person would be away on a fishing boat for a while, no contact, no other people other than the people you were with. So you kind of became invisible to your friends and family because you weren't around.
Right.
I would like, and I don't like sequels or prequels and stuff, but I would like a little more knowledge on why he acts the way he does. Like, why the director or the writer feel like, why was he a troubled human being? I would love to know that, because that would give us more insight into why he felt the need to rip apart a 3- and 4-year-old.
Yeah. So I find the direction that they took interesting, but at the same time, it does eliminate some of the fear of the unknown that I personally love so much. It's always more terrifying when you don't know what kind of madman is pulling the strings.
Yeah.
So, which the remake goes that direction. But I think by the end, you don't know shit about this guy still. And that's what makes that.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Scarier? In the opening, you don't know anything about this guy. He's Billy from Black Christmas.
Yeah, he's just a voice.
Yeah.
That's all he is.
And then in the second act, you learn a lot about him, and you actually spend time with him.
You almost start to feel bad for him.
Yeah, you feel pity.
But then all of a sudden, he snaps, and him going after Jill, it's like, why did you build up all this character backstory and this juxtaposition for him to just slide back and become this horrifying monster again?
I don't know. It's
weird.
Interesting choice. I think they were trying something different.
They did. They found something different with those first 20 minutes. I will say, as someone who has just seen this movie for the first time, and the first 20 minutes were hyped up pretty big by a lot of big named people, I think this movie was kind of bad.
As a whole, or?
As the last two acts. I think they could have, but it would have made the movie much shorter. I think that first like 20 minutes could have been an amazing short film.
Agreed.
And we didn't need the rest of it, really.
The last 20 minutes could have been like its sequel.
The sequel to that story.
That short film.
Because I don't believe that Carol King is a 17-year-old girl when she's a babysitter, because I know for a fact in this movie she was like 21, 22.
Yeah.
It's like some people can get away with that. Oh, okay, you're 20, you're playing a teenager. All right, fine, whatever. But there's something about that woman, because the first time I ever saw Carol King was in fucking Princess Bride. To me, I'm like, well, she's just a little old lady.
I think she just, her presence is very experienced.
Her like voice also takes me out of it, too.
Yeah, because she has that, like,
that wonderful, like, hey, guy, how are you? Like, that kind of voice.
But it's like, she has this speech pattern that's very...
It's interesting. I love it.
It's different.
But for this movie, no. I even think the person they got to play Tracy just really didn't put me in the seat of why is this man obsessed with her?
I can actually answer, I think.
Okay.
I think he was gravitating towards her because she was isolating herself.
Okay.
She was a woman that lived alone, was going out every night, drowning herself in booze.
Yeah.
Alone. Like, she would go to this little bar near her apartment and drink.
Near? I believe she walked 10 miles to get this goddamn apartment.
It's a movie. I don't think it was that far.
Like, what the fuck? She's in heels, too.
But I think that's why he felt like he wanted to be close to her, because she was similar to him in some way.
I'd love to talk about the private investigator, i.e., I believe it was the detective.
He was initially the detective that...
on the case with the children.
Yeah.
And then he became a private investigator.
Yeah, he said when they did the time skip, he had left the force 3.5 years ago. So it was like roughly 4 years after the thing with the kids.
Yeah, and he'd never been the same after that case, and he just couldn't do it. Which I was like, yeah, if you're the person that has to go investigate a case where children were ripped to pieces.
Yeah.
Like, why did they put him in a psych ward? That man should have been thrown in maximum security and the key thrown away.
I don't know. It was a different time, so maybe...
It smells a little bit like a Haddonfield injection into a film. Oh, we put Michael Myers in a psychiatric ward because he killed his sister.
Yeah, but even he was in like a maximum security type of psychiatric ward.
This didn't really look like it. It looked like a normal psych facility.
Yeah.
How did he fucking escape?
Never told. We have no idea.
I hate it when movies don't give me more info. I will always hate it. There's just a few questions I need. I need like 5 questions answered in this film for me to be happy. One, I want to know a little bit about him prior, like maybe 5 minutes. How the fuck did you get in? Why the fuck did you put him in a psych ward?
I think they even asked that at one point. How did he get into the house?
The cop asked the detective. We can't even figure out how he got in. And I'm like, for the lattice work in the front, guys, there's a window open in the first scene. I saw it. Oh, look. Oh, look, kids. Rip. Yay. Like, I mean.
Do you think he was just trying to make confetti out of her?
He saw it at a children's birthday party once and was like, piñatas! That's entrails, not candy. Gosh darn.
Oh, God.
Can you imagine if he saw the world through like a different perspective and ripping children open was like, God told me I have to kill the children. They're plagues, they're menaces. Like, oh, he in his mind like had these glasses that like clouded him. Those are cop out films, and I fucking hate those kind of films. Like, oh well, it was the parent all along. Get the fuck out of here. Go.
No.
No. Although that dad was really fucking creepy in the beginning of the film. Mr. Melanakis. He's like, oh, there's no frat yogurt. Get out of here. You're not schnupping the babysitter. Go. Your kids are already dead, so it's not like you can corrupt them. Oh.
So shall we get into the breakdown?
Absolutely.
So Jill Johnson is babysitting the children of Dr. Mandrakis. Not Milanakis. That's a whole different asshole.
Milanakis.
Andy Milanakis.
Andy Milanakis? Yeah, help me.
He was a fucking, like, really foul-mouthed kid. He had his own show. In, like, late 90s, early 2000s.
What? Hang on. We're going for a detour for a second. Who the hell is that?
He was very famous for a little while.
Oh, my God. He's 50 years old. He's 50 years old now.
When the children are asleep, Joe starts to receive telephone calls from a man who keeps asking her if she has checked the children. Jill initially dismisses the call as a practical joke. However, he keeps calling again and again. The calls increase in frequency and threat level, and Jill becomes frightened. She calls the police, who tell her to try, next time he calls, try and keep him on the line long enough for them to trace the call. Mm-hmm. So she receives one final call from this harasser, and immediately after the conversation, the police call her back and inform her that the calls are coming from inside the house. Probably one of the most infamous lines in the movie. We've traced the call.
It's coming from inside the house.
So she immediately kind of freaks out. She starts to see one of the doors at the top of the stairs opening. She sees the intruder's shadow. And we later find out that this is... His name is Kurt Duncan. Mm-hmm. He's an English merchant seaman.
Seaman.
And he killed the children shortly after she arrived. So they've been dead this entire fucking time. Parents didn't know.
Maybe the mom should have checked on her kids before she left.
Oh!
You'd think they would have, but no, they were rushing out. They were late. Absent parents. So the police arrive. There's a bit of a time skip here where, like, she gets out the front door.
It's got to be like an hour.
Yeah, it has
maybe
to be
a half
like
hour
tops. She gets out the front door, and we transition. A pretty cool transition, actually.
She opens the door, screams, sees the detective, and it's the detective coming in later investigating the crime scene. It's like, well, I was like, hang on. They use that tactic a couple of times, which is actually kind of, I like that.
It was a cool transition. I like it. And so this is where we learn a little bit about the killer, what he's done. And following this, we transition 7 years later. Mm. And we learn that Duncan has escaped from his psychiatric facility.
No information on how.
No, we just learned that he escaped. Who the fuck knows?
And it's not like anybody else is looking for him. Nobody's actively looking for this man. He killed
No one.
He killed two kids 7 years ago, and they're just like, oh, we got out.
No one's trying to find him, so Dr. Mandrakis hires the detective, who is now... he retired from the force, but runs, like, a private investigation.
Yeah, he's a PI.
And so Dr. Mandrakis hires him to try and track this guy down because he's afraid that
they're gonna come. He's gonna come after.
He's gonna come back.
Yeah.
Not knowing that this is happening, Duncan is basically just wandering since his escape.
He's homeless and just wandering.
He finds himself at a bar where he meets Tracy. Now, there's an altercation here because he kind of, I don't even think he's doing it intentionally, but he ends up, like, harassing Tracy.
Yeah.
And another guy in the bar sees this happening and, like, beats the shit out of him.
Oh, God, yeah.
And pours alcohol all over him. And, like, this guy is very clearly a hothead because he's even told at one point, like, stop it.
Yeah, knock it off. And the bar owner tries to report a fight, and the guy's like, you're not reporting that.
Yeah,
and hangs the phone
up on him.
That would have solved everything right there if they would have just arrested him.
Yeah, but no. After this altercation, Duncan actually ends up following Tracy back to her apartment, and he kind of explains to her a little bit, like, he's like that he's new in town, that he doesn't really have anywhere to go.
And he says it several times too.
Yeah, and she can definitely tell something's wrong and gets a bad vibe, but she kind of like shows him pity a little bit as well. She tries to be nice to him, but she's like trying to get him to leave, hoping that this is the last time she's ever going to see him. Meanwhile, the detective, his name's Clifford. Mm. He's not a big red dog, though.
I was going to say that. It's a big red dog.
He's starting to become a little bit obsessed with trying to find Duncan. And he confides in one of his friends, Lieutenant Garber.
Who was on scene.
Yes.
At the crime.
He was on scene at the original crime. And he confides in him that his intention is that he's going to kill Duncan when he finds him. Because recommitting him is, he could always just get out again. Garber, who, like we said, he was also at the original crime scene. He agrees to collaborate in the sense that, like, if he learns anything, he'll tell Clifford about it. Clifford, this is over a period of time, but like I'm gonna kind of let it abridge it because we're basically for a while just like watching the investigation unfold and like Duncan kind of wandering.
At one point he takes refuge at a missionary rescue where they give him food, a shower, and you just see him mentally break down.
Yeah.
And it was weird because he is just stark naked in front of a mirror, just, well, and he starts just crying.
Yes, because this happens right after. So during the investigation, Clifford talks to one of the other homeless guys that interacted with Duncan, and that guy kind of agrees to like
give him a hand, like, help him out.
If I find out where he's going to be, I'll let you know.
In the context, oh, I have some money to give him, so yeah. You got to bring him to me so I can give the money to him.
And then he runs into that other homeless guy outside of the missionary, and the homeless guy calls him crazy something.
Crazy Jay.
And I think that in a way sparks his memory of what he did.
Yeah. He starts spiraling because he's like, I can't trust you.
When he's looking in the mirror, he's remembering the crime because we actually get a couple of flashes of him like covered in blood.
Yeah. You actually see kind of not 100% what he did, but it's the parts of the beginning of the movie that horror fans would be like, I don't want to know this.
Yeah.
Honestly, like, I saw your face watching this and you were like,
I don't want to see this.
Like, you don't, there's something about the mystery.
Yes.
That's why I think, in my opinion, like, Freddy and Jason and all of them are schlocky horror characters.
Oh, yeah.
Like, in their first movies, they were great. But as time went on, they get schlockier. Like, and I don't mean schlock like a bad thing. Because to me, when he and I talk about, oh, God, we're going to watch the schlockiest shit. We want to watch the schlock. We want to watch the crap stuff. Because sometimes the crap can be golden. How many people have heard of, and we're doing it this year, Sleepaway Camp? How many honestly have ever heard of that movie? I've never heard of that movie till I watched In Search of Darkness. And I am obsessed with the fact that we're actually going to watch that because it seems terrifying. But it seems like the stuff that's campy, schlocky, terrifying doesn't get anywhere in the world other than in its niche horror place. There are so many horror movies that I'm like, oh my God, why haven't the world seen these films?
You don't know anything about Sleepaway Camp.
I know nothing. All I know is the girl looks like a fucking animatronic character at one point.
Let's keep it that way.
Which is perfect. But it's like that, where I went in not knowing anything about this film except for the first 20 minutes. And that, knowing those first 20 minutes were amazing, kind of ruins and spoils, like a rotten kind of spoiling, the last two acts.
Yeah. So Clifford ends up tracking Duncan to Tracy's house. He very rudely tells Tracy that Duncan's, he tells her about, hang on. He very rudely tells Tracy about what Duncan did, about how he literally tore the Mandrake, about how he literally tore the Mandrakis children apart with his bare hands. And like, this obviously causes Tracy to agree to act as bait at the bar. Which I actually didn't like realize that's what he was asking her to do at first. I think like my brain slipped away for a minute. But then when we saw her go to the bar and then the detective follow her back, I was like, oh, okay. It was a sting. Duncan unfortunately never shows up. Clifford then, like, he leaves, but Duncan turns out was hiding inside Tracy's house.
So creepy.
He was hiding in a closet waiting for her. And we were joking about how he was like rummaging through her panties. Why do you got these?
Hey, these ones are from 59. Why do you still have these granny panties?
These got fucking fringe on them. Are you kidding me?
Dude, there's a shit stain on this one. I'm sorry, those are my period undies. What the fuck's a period undie? If it's gross, throw it out. No, you don't understand. They're comfortable, and I will kill you if you touch my panties. Kill you.
So, well,
we're assholes.
Yes, we are. When Tracy is left alone, Duncan makes himself known, and Tracy screams for help. Clifford hears this from outside. He comes running back in. He chases Duncan from the scene, but he ends up losing his trail somewhere in downtown Los Angeles.
I thought it was supposed to be New York City.
Nope.
Might be. So it's downtown L.A., which is, no offense to anybody who lives in L.A., it is a cesspool, and I'm so sorry you live there.
Now, from this point, we shift into Act 3.
Yes.
We are reintroduced to Jill.
Who's Jill...
something. She's now married, has two children. One night, her and her husband, Steven.
Her son's name is Steven as well.
I hate people that name their children after themselves.
Hey, Sean.
Sean,
that means you hate yourself.
I know. No, that would mean I'd hate my dad, but I don't hate my dad. Like, I just hate that he named me after himself.
You just wish creativity was one of the things that they would have done when naming you.
Yes. They're going out to dinner to celebrate that he got a promotion at work. Their children are being babysat by a young woman named Sharon.
Sharon.
While they're at the restaurant, Jill gets a phone call. And the moment she hears Duncan's voice asking her again, "Have you checked the children?" she fucking melts down and
she just becomes a screaming lunatic.
She causes a huge uproar in the restaurant. She's like, he's back. It's him.
He has my babies.
And so the police end up escorting her and Steven back to their house. They discover that everything's fine. The kids are all right. Once the police are involved, Garber ends up hearing about this and informs Clifford immediately. Mm-hmm. Clifford tries to call Jill, but he can't get a hold of her.
Now, what happened? Did the power in the house go out, or did they cut the line?
Duncan cut the line.
Okay.
So he couldn't get...
Because the lights went out, too, at one point.
Yeah. But I think he cut the phone line before then, because we saw Clifford trying to call, and it was busy.
And he asked the operator, what does this mean? Like, oh, either the phone number's disconnected, or, you know, it's not in service. And like, what do you mean it's not in service?
Now, we're getting towards the very end of this movie, which I'll draw attention to once we get there, but I have a bit of a problem with it. So, Clifford's trying to call Jill, but the lion is apparently dead, which he feels is like... He feels isn't right. He's like...
It's like a calling card.
It feels like a little too close to that original case.
Yep.
So later that night, Jill she obviously can't sleep now because she knows this guy's out there. She's afraid for her kids. So she goes in and checks on them in the night, and she discovers that her son is holding is asleep, but he's holding a piece of candy.
He's holding like
it's almost like a chocolate pop,
like a Laffy Taffy or some sort of thing on a stick, like a cow tail.
Yeah, but she tries to ask him where he got it, but he's like
he's too sleepy.
He's sleepy, so she takes it from him. It worries her that he had this thing, and she goes back to her room where her husband's asleep, and she sits in bed, just kind of sitting there, staring around the room. She's very nervous, and then she starts to hear Duncan's voice calling to her from her closet. She tries to awaken her husband, only to realize that the man laying next to her is not her husband. It's Duncan. And
if we're ever robbed, that's the noise you need to make. Take my wallet.
Duncan chases Jill across the room. He attempts to kill her, but Clifford arrives just in the nick of time and shoots Duncan in the chest, killing him.
Plot twist, Duncan and Clifford were in cahoots the whole time.
This is my problem.
The savior thing?
Yes, because as far as we know, we have no idea where he physically was in space or time. Yet he teleported there and saved her.
Well, okay, there are a couple of context clues. One, Duncan picks the paper up off the street, recognizing Jill's photo in the paper.
Yeah.
She had got recognized for some fundraiser thing, and she had an article in the paper. Two, he was already trying to get in contact with her. Gerber was already trying to get in contact with Jill prior to any of this happening, so we don't 100% know when he cut the line.
Yeah.
So he could have already been on his way knowing that something was wrong. So while I agree with you, I don't like it, it's not as bad and plot holey. There are holes. They're just not as big as I think
they should have paced it out, at least in the edit, better, to where like him trying to call her was sooner. And then maybe just thrown in a shot of him driving. So it's like you had that like
or trying bridge. To get a hold of his friend, and his friend being like, I don't have any cops that can go over there. He's like, I'm trying to get there as fast as I can. All right, we'll send somebody else too.
Like, yeah, like anything.
This is what I mean by directors and writers like cutting certain things out. What these companies and what these directors cut out sometimes is exactly what us little people need for just a tiny bit of context clue.
Yeah.
It would have taken them. Granted, it probably would have taken him about an hour to do a five or ten minute second scene like that. But just adding that in would have made the third act make more sense. The second act was just weird. I feel like the second act was filler. But the first act and the third act could have been fine if there were a couple more little, just a few answers to some questions.
Yeah.
That is it.
Anyway, after Duncan is taken out. Steven is found in the closet. He's unconscious but alive. The children are safe. And that's where the movie ends.
But it ends on the camera panning out from the home with Duncan's face just fading in the background.
Yes.
Like that menacing like face. Because there's a face he makes when she flips the covers back and it looks primal and terrifying. And I was like, oh man! If I ever saw that man sleeping next to me, I would kick his ass. No, thank you.
But that's, in a nutshell, When a Stranger Calls.
Technically, isn't anybody who calls you that doesn't know you a stranger calling?
Yes.
So this could be all a ploy about how telemarketers are bad people and they'll kill you.
Yeah. I mean,
Duncan was a telemarketer working for the we need to contact you in regarding to your car's extended warranty.
That's all he wanted.
That's it. That's all he wanted. And the children were like, my parents don't want to talk to you. And he just killed them because he's like, fuck you and your car's extended warranty. I will get someone to buy this. That's all it was. That's it.
Oh, God. We'll just turn this into a fucking comedy.
No. It will be a horror movie. We just need to get a beloved comedian to play the bad guy like 1 hour photo was.
Oh, God, no. See, look, no. Nobody can...
I've never seen 1 hour photo.
Not many people can make that switch the way Robin Williams did. He was just a phenomenal actor.
The demons in his head played very well with him that day.
No shit. All right, so are we shifting to our closing questions?
Yes.
Did you have any favorites?
I did not write any favorites down because that first 20-minute scene I knew would be my favorite.
Yes.
Yeah.
That first 23 minutes is fucking amazing.
And the worst part about it is the rest of the movie has nothing memorable.
I disagree.
Okay,
there's
all right.
One other moment that I wrote down because I loved it. Like, it was exactly what I wanted at the moment it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the phone call at the restaurant.
Okay, all
so
right.
So that moment where the waiter comes up and is like, oh, Mr. and Mrs., whatever the fuck their names were.
Yeah.
Telephone call for you. She's like, oh, it's probably just Sharon. I was like, she's going to walk to that phone.
It's not Sharon.
And she's going to hear, why haven't you checked the children?
Bish, that's not Sharon.
And that's exactly what you get. And I was so fucking happy when it happened. And like watching her melt down during, like right after that.
Mm.
It was great. Like, it was perfect.
Eerie. Extremely eerie. That's what I'd say.
Do you feel you would... Regardless of the fact that there's a remake,
okay.
Do you feel that you would have done anything differently?
I would have extended the first act and extended the third act and gotten rid of the second act. Mostly because I would have shown what caused him to be like this. I would have shown him versus Jill, basically, in the beginning. I would show his journey in the psych ward and him getting out, but I wouldn't show the in-between stuff because it would keep up the mystery of who he is or what he is. Kind of like Mike Myers. Mike Myers doesn't fucking talk.
Michael Myers.
Oh, whatever.
Mike Myers is a whole different person.
Oh, he never shuts the fuck up. I'm sorry. Michael Myers never talks, never says anything. You know nothing about him. The second act was, I knew too much about Duncan and I don't want to care about him. I want him to be the bad guy, not, oh, I feel sorry for him. So at the end, it's like, oh, he got shot. He's misunderstood. No, I don't want that in my brain. I think it was, while made for an interesting story, that's kind of why people are like, ah, after that first act, just turn it off. Basically.
Yeah.
How about you?
I kind of agree. I think I love the first act, and I think the remake did it right in taking that first act and making it the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think what they could have done, what I would probably do if like somebody said, hey, we want you to make When a Stranger Calls Again,
mm-hmm.
I would do exactly what the remake did, but then pitch it as, all right, I want to do the first 23 minutes extended into an hour and a half, and then I want to do a sequel that's the last 20 minutes
mm-hmm.
extended into an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Which I think you could do. I think there's enough like wiggle room within that to be able to bridge that gap. Like, you could obviously tack on the extra information of like, oh, him breaking out of the facility and some other shit in between, but I think that would be pretty cool. I've never seen When a Stranger Calls Back. Like the actual sequel to this. Mm. I've never seen it. I know very little about it.
Well, you know what that means. I'm going to have to do it next year.
Maybe. We shall see.
We shall see.
But is this mainstream exploitation or other?
Other.
Explain.
Oh, God. Why do you make me show my homework? I believe it was a great idea, but to make it exploitation, I can't pinpoint what it would be because there are too many elements in it. It is a horror. It is a thriller. It does have some, like, ticks in certain boxes, like a home invasion exploitation, a babysitter exploitation, because surprisingly That really is a thing. There's a lot of movies with babysitters. Tons. Yeah. But I don't think it's a solid exploitation, so I'm going to say other. You disagree, don't you?
I don't disagree.
What?
I would absolutely classify this as other. It is not exploitation.
No.
It doesn't do anything to an exploitive level.
But it tries to tick certain boxes. It's like, okay, here's this. But it doesn't tick enough of them to make it. There's too many ticks in all these columns.
I think it's just, it tries to be a thriller through and through. Mm. Like, it's not attempting to go over the top in any form or fashion. Yeah, I don't think, and it's not mainstream enough.
No.
Like, barring the fact that it's the opening scene is, like, super famous now.
It's a cult famous.
Yeah, it's not, like...
To be fair, when we first started dating, we talked about movies. There are certain horror movies, certain exploitation movies that you know that are famous. Like, these films are famous for. And knowing when this one popped up with the Shudder thing, I was like, I looked at you, I'm like, why is this famous? And you're like, because it's the best 20 minutes that inspired other films. Like, this inspired Scream, and you can see other films inspired by this too. Other home invasion movies. Which is incredible, but it sucks when the original, nobody knows this movie. You don't know this movie. I didn't know Carol King was in this. When you think of Carol King, you think Princess Bride. You think, oh God.
I mean, I think of this,
Maya,
but.
Maya! That's the lady you think of. You don't think of this.
I mean, I do.
It's because you're a fucking nut job.
Yeah, that's true.
You're a wackadoodle.
I am.
You should be with Duncan in the psych ward. I think you'd enjoy the electroshock therapy. It's a little zingy.
Do you have anything else you would like to discuss about When a Stranger Calls?
No. I think we've covered it pretty well. I will say I wish that the first 20 minutes scared me like it's supposed to.
It's hard
because
now.
I saw this on other stuff. I didn't see this in the film first, so I knew what was coming. And this one, I was actually disappointed. I got bored in the second act. I was really, really disappointed because I wanted to like dedicate a lot to it.
Well, that's the problem. Like, this movie is what everyone says it is. Like, it's really good at the beginning. It's very slow and mundane during the middle. Ramps up
and then the end is like, bam, it's done.
Yeah.
It was so fast. I wanted a little more. And I'm like, wait a minute. She was just in her kitchen getting water and now she's crying in the officer's arms. What happened? If you blink, you're going to miss the ending.
Right. I like the movie for what it is.
Mm.
I think it definitely is trying to do some interesting things. Not going to be for everybody.
No. Nope. But if you want to see what inspired Scream, watch the first 20 minutes.
Agreed.
Like, just seeing how Carol portrays Jill and how terrified she is, it's great. Oh, watch it on VHS too. Oh, we got a really good transfer.
We did get a really good transfer.
There was one little boop in the beginning and that was it. It was done. This was really good.
This tape that we have is in very good shape.
The guy that we get these tapes from, he puts little descriptions on the side. Like, this guy is amazing. Shout out to this dude. I don't know who he is.
This one's actually not one of his.
I thought it was from the writing on the other side.
No, that's just a Columbia TriStar sticker.
What?
Yeah.
No, it confused me.
Yeah, no, this is not one of his, surprisingly.
I thought this was. Didn't we get it out of that bin?
No, this one, I think I don't remember where I picked this one up.
This was not at our secret, super secret safe place?
No, this was somewhere else.
Good God, was this a Goodwill?
It might have been.
Oh, wow. Goodwill's got some good shit, guys.
Every now and then.
Every now and then, we go into Goodwill and we're like, hey.
But I think that's going to wrap up our discussion on When a Stranger Calls. Don't go anywhere just yet. Please stay tuned for the coming attractions. We'll be right back.
Johnny Williams was killed?
Yes. Find something?
Animal tracks.
Whoever is bitten by a werewolf and lives becomes a werewolf himself.
Oh, don't hand me that. You're just wasting your time.
The wolf bit you, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, he did. You wouldn't want to run away with a murderer, would you?
Oh, Larry, you're not. You know you're not.
I killed Bayla. I killed Richardson. If I stay here any longer, you can't tell who'll be next.
Getting spooky.
We're getting a little hairy. So this is the first classic Universal monster we're doing. The Wolfman. I've never seen this, but this is another one that was on the Shudder list. This is one of the original transformation films.
Yes, the classic Lon Chaney performance
of Wolfman.
The one that everybody praises. I've seen this a couple of times.
I have never seen it.
I've never been a gigantic Universal fan. I like them for what they are. But the classic monster movies, I have to be in a mood for.
Classic monster movies to me are, you've got to know where your roots are. And if you really want to explore the roots of certain films like An American Werewolf in London, like, you know, even Trick or Treat, you've got to go to the original. And I've always wanted to see Lon Chaney's performance because it's revered, like Bela Lugosi's, as one of the greatest transformation Wolfman films.
Yeah.
We have a bunch of them. I don't think we have any Bela Lugosi, unfortunately, but we have
Dracula.
We have Dracula?
Yeah.
Why haven't we watched Dracula yet? I've never seen Dracula.
You haven't picked it.
Well, we're picking it next, motherfucker. No, but I've always liked the Universal Monsters. When I'd go to Universal Studios, I always watched the Universal Monsters do the Halloween performance, and it was really cool. And the Wolfman and Dracula are my favorites, so do Wolfman. Because I'm a nerd. I like puppies. Come here, puppy.
I think this will be fun to watch.
Mm.
It's, I don't know, it's always fun to kind of revisit the classic black and white films, in my opinion.
I think that's going to do it for this episode.
All right. Well, then, if you want to keep up on everything that we're doing, follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Grindhouse Podcast. We're on Twitter at Grindhouse Cast, if Twitter's still active anymore.
Yeah, does anybody use Twitter anymore?
It's slowly fucking dying, yeah, as Elon runs it into the ground.
Thanks, Mr. Musk.
You can find us on Discord, where you can mostly chat with Leah about this film or any of the films that we previously covered. You can suggest us some movies that you might like us to cover on the podcast. We're always looking for suggestions.
Always.
Not that any of you listen or talk to us in any form.
Hey, some people do.
Do they? Does anybody care? Let us know. Honestly, if you don't,
My mom did say that she was listening to the Santa Claus the other day, and she gave me a look. She was like, so I'm listening to the Santa Claus. I'm like, is that the one where I talk about my trauma, and am I in trouble? That's what I said. And she looks at me and goes, I'm halfway through. I'm like, get ready for the ending.
All the links for everything are going to be down in the show notes. Listen to us first thing every Monday morning and give us a rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your morning fix. If you like what we're doing and you want to show this show some support, you can subscribe over on Patreon or directly through Acast, where you can get yourself access to ad-free listening and unlock some fun exclusive bonus content that we will put more of up at some point when, you know, life allows. Until next week, I'm Sean.
I'm Leah.
Thanks for listening, and keep watching.
Bye-bye now. Bye-bye. Have you checked the children?